there is a clash between NATO and Russia, and it looks to me like Russia is preparing for that eventuality. They have changed the way they're doing their recruitment of their required service. They've changed the way they're doing that to now on a rotating basis. They're getting, I think it was like 3 million reservists to certain levels of training that they could be brought on board to active duty on short notice if they need to. They are stockpiling huge amounts by many reports that I've seen of artillery shells, artillery pieces, armor, the missiles, the long-range drones, all kinds of things. A lot of that's going into stockpiles because they believe that there is a possibility they could end up fighting with NATO. On the other side of that line, you have NATO feeding into that and giving Russia, I think, plenty of reason to believe that could be happening, even aside from whether the Russia-Ukraine war gets solved, even down the road from that. And here is Mark Rutte talking about to I think it was just this morning in Romania, how he's talking about where they could go next against, well, whomever may attack.
If an attack would take place from whoever, be it the Russians or whoever would attack NATO or would attack Romania particularly, it is not only Eastern Sentry which will help you. It is not only the forward land forces which will help you. It is then the whole of NATO which will come to the rescue with its fleet of F-35s, its full naval capacity, and its full land forces capacity. This is how NATO works.
Yeah, that's how NATO works on paper. But let me just ask your opinion. How ironclad is that? I know what it says on paper. I know what they say at all these summits, like the Washington summit last year and the one they just had here a few months back. But, I mean, is Spain and Italy really going to come rushing to plunge themselves into a war with Russia over something that may happen in Romania or possibly Poland? I mean, how ironclad is that, do you think?
It's about as ironclad as a wet paper bag. I mean, the fact is that there are two issues here. There's a military issue and a political issue. Let's take the military issue first. I wrote, and you and I talked about this about 6 or 7 months ago. I wrote an article, Responsible Statecraft, in which I explained that NATO couldn't win a war against Russia. I'm just trying to remember what I said, but essentially I said that there are a number of issues in there. Firstly, we haven't got the Americans, for example, would need to be on board. Politically, the Americans will never be on board because you won't want to put land forces in, but we would need American land forces here to win a war against Russia. We need to get those American land forces across the Atlantic, and we do not have the anti-submarine warfare or mine warfare capabilities to prevent the interception of those forces by Russian submarines and Russian mine warfare. When those forces arrive, the next thing that I would expect in a war is I would expect the Russians to be using hypersonic missiles and ballistic missiles to actually conventional missiles, so not going to the nuclear threshold, but to attack key parts of our infrastructure. From memory, there are three of our major ports in the West, our LNG ports, are critical to the maintenance of our energy supplies. You've then got Western armies, which have not got the experience. By far the best army in the West is probably the Ukrainians, and they're being they're being defeated. So the idea that you can suddenly have the rest of the Western armies in a position to fight successfully against Russia is fantasy. And the last bit of it is our leadership. Yeah, we know strategically that our strategic leaders are not covering themselves in glory. We know that Ramstein was the place where British and American generals were part and parcel of guiding the Ukrainian armed forces in, for example, assaults on the Suravenko line, which achieved no penetration and nothing other than significant, almost World War One levels of casualty. Yes, so that's on it militarily. We can't win militarily. Politically, there's no appetite, and there's absolutely no appetite in the States, as far as I can see. But there's very little appetite, other than perhaps in the Baltic states and one or two places closer to Russia, for any war with Russia. So the idea that we can win a war against Russia is just it's fantasy. But the fundamental point is this, which is the Russians don't want to have a war with us. you know, they have clear objectives. They know what they want to achieve. So what we've got at the moment is NATO under Rutte, you know, spamming up for a war which Russia doesn't want in the first place. So the idea that Russia's going to go further than probably Novorossiya, where's the evidence? You know, the evidence is largely speaking, there is no evidence. The evidence is, as such people in NATO think about it, is largely speaking with people like Rutte and the, you know, the military committee, who have taken the view that because Russia invaded Ukraine, that the rest of NATO is on the menu. Well, of course it's not. There's no evidence for that whatsoever, and there is no evidence to me that Russia is doing anything other in those preparations, Danny. And I would do the same if I were in their situation, in preparing for a defensive war. So they're preparing to defend themselves against a NATO offence, and I would be. As a Russian, I'd be worried about the nuclear escalation, but otherwise I'd be reasonably content that I can defend myself against NATO, because the NATO that I'd be defending myself against is weak in the Ukrainian army, who I've thoroughly defeated, and they're, they don't have the capacity to win. So, yeah, I don't want to do it, and I don't want to spend resources in it, but it's the prudent thing to do.
You know, that's so ironic, Steve, because In an attempt to look tough and to deter Russia, you're actually making yourselves more vulnerable by revealing your weakness, not by showing strength. Because the only people who are sold on these statements by Rutte are some of the people either in the elite themselves in Europe, or maybe some of the people who, I mean, a lot of people don't have any reason not to believe their leaders. Well, I mean, they do, but they still believe them anyway when they talk about how strong they are. And you talk about how it kind of briefs well all these things you're going to do, that there'll be fleets of F-35s and all this kind of stuff, but it doesn't really match up on the reality sheet. But where it does meet the reality sheet is that there's lots and lots of money being plowed into this. Mm-hmm. And at a separate meeting that Mark Rutte also seemed to say, hey, we're not content to just get ready to fight Russia. We want to fight China and North Korea too.
Because the threats we face are real and lasting. Russia's unprovoked war against Ukraine is the most obvious example of the threat. But the danger posed by Russia will not end when this war does. For the foreseeable future, Russia will remain a destabilizing force in Europe and the world. And Russia is not alone in its efforts to undermine the global rules. As you know, it is working with China, with North Korea, with Iran and others. They are increasing their defense industrial collaboration to unprecedented levels. They are preparing for long-term confrontation. We cannot be naive. We must be prepared. President Roosevelt famously said that powerful enemies must be outfought and outproduced. And that was in 1942. And the same can be said today.
Yeah, they want to outspend them. See, now that's where you get into the reality. I think a lot of people in the elite are all too happy to fan up the risk there. But I bet they don't want to actually make good on it, but they sure do want to make good on getting the cash to come in. What do you make of that?
I think President Roosevelt's grandfather, I think, was Teddy Roosevelt, wasn't it? He also said, speak softly, but carry a big stick. Well, Rutte's doing the opposite. He's speaking loudly with a very weak stick. And I think actually the Russians are doing the opposite. And it's about time that actually we, to be honest, it's about time we got rid of leaders like Rutte, because actually it's leaders like Rutte and von der Leyen who are a critical part of the problem, because actually a person with really good strategic judgment. And you don't need to be a military person to have strategic judgment. I mean, look at Lincoln. He had excellent strategic judgment, Abraham Lincoln. And you need to be a person who can actually look at the strategic facts and work out what needs to be done. I mean, what Rutte was saying, and I think actually he was, let's start with NATO in Europe. I said, I think in that Responsible Statecraft article, that NATO exists to NATO's existence is the reason that Russia is confronting it. But NATO hasn't got. NATO exists to defend itself against the threat created by its own existence. And unfortunately, NATO doesn't have the capacity to defeat the threat that its own existence creates. So the idea that actually, as well as being ready to defeat Russia, we can head across to China. I mean, how are we going to get there? The only people with logistics capacity to get to China are the Americans. I mean, let's not beat about the bush. The U.S. armed forces have incredible power projection capability. Probably not as good as it was a few years ago, but even so, it outmatches any other country in the world. But that power projection capability is largely speaking based on air and sea. And it's also, I think, probably increasingly under threat now, because look at the experiences right in the Red Sea. And imagine what it would be like actually trying to retake Taiwan. And I think that's not a fight that I, as a naval officer, would want to be in. So America has fantastic power projection capability, but actually it's clear that Russia and probably China have the capacity to make it a very expensive thing to power project into the Eurasian landmass. And furthermore, it's also about land forces. You know, you talked about the scale of the Russian land forces getting up to 3 million. I mean, where is the unity in Europe to actually get to those sorts of figures? But also, yes, Let's have a think and look about the Chinese land forces. You know, who wasn't, which of us former military people weren't incredibly impressed by the Chinese parades not such a long time ago, and the capacities that they were producing. And there's a much more deeper point as well, Danny, which is that a nation's ability, its national power, is based on two fundamental factors. And this is where I'm in a slightly different place to John Mearsheimer, which is unusual because I'm a huge fan of his. He says that a national power is based on wealth and population. I think that's right, but I think they're also two equally fundamental, and perhaps more fundamental. The first is industrial capacity,
yeah,
and the second is energy. And what's clear is that the West has basically deindustrialized. And we've, because of the Chicago School economists, have send it all out to China and we'll do things as cheaply as possible. You know, the industrial powerhouse of the world now is China. Used to be the States. I can remember going back to the States in about 2007. Even then, you know, the east of the States was still amazing in terms of what was possible in terms of production. But there's no doubt that, you know, China is in the van now. China is leading this. And let's not forget the Russians. You know, the Russians are at the moment are out producing the West in 155mm ammunition. You know, that's out producing the whole of the West. That's the United States and European Union put together. So, you know, that's the Russians have significant industrial capacity. And when we come to energy, that's a weaker spot for the Chinese, but it's absolute vulnerability for the Europeans. The Europeans are critically dependent on energy supplies, whereas the Russians are completely your target. They have as much energy as they need, and they can export the remainder of it. So the fundamental facts are that in terms of the balance of power, America, I don't think, has the balance of capability to actually defeat Russia or China on its own, in part because of their location. And Europe certainly doesn't. So the idea that we should get ourselves ready for confronting them, it's about time we started talking to them, Danny. I would like to see, although I doubt I ever will, Ritter and von der Leyen actually starting to say, okay, perhaps we should be talking to the Chinese and the Russians, and let's start with Putin. As soon as we see that, we'll know we've got the right leaders. I doubt, though, it'll happen in the short term, unfortunately.
Now, I doubt that it'll happen in any term, especially with the roots of von der Leyen and Kaja Kallas and et cetera. I mean, I think that they're just decisively locked in where they are, and the only way you can do is to have them replaced and put somebody else in there who can get the job done. Otherwise, I think they're going to drive this ship of state into some pretty significant rocks, and that's not going to be play out well for anybody. Yeah. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on today and providing some of these stark observations, especially on what is and isn't possible and what's needed, what we have to have done. I mean, I think diplomacy is the only way to get this done, recognizing ground truth reality, and that there are some things you're just not going to get done. And diplomacy doesn't mean you're going to accomplish everything you want. It just means you're going to accomplish what you really can. Going back to your comment, ends, ways, and means.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that I think about this is there are two, this argument, the discussion that we're having about this war happens at two levels. It happens at the levels of morality, and then it happens at the levels of power. Now, the power is the more important one, but in levels of morality, people still think that we're on the right side and the Russians are on the wrong side. I don't agree with that. You don't agree with that. Many of the independent commentators don't agree with it. But even if we were right, the fact is that we don't have the power to impose the moral answer to this war that the Russians do. So you've got to accept that actually we are a weaker side of the argument, and the sooner we accept that, difficult though it may be in the West, then the better. Because actually, the longer that we go on like this, the more we are squandering resources and squandering our reputation around the rest of the world. Simply because actually that we've got a political narrative that we, the West, are in the right, and it's about time everybody else listened to us, and we're going to sort the Russians out. Not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So sooner and better we accept it, the better.
Listen, in just the last few minutes, and we don't want to have a whole lot of time here left, but you brought up the issue of the morality, and then in terms of reality on the ground, it is subordinate. I mean, we just got to be honest with it, to the power projections and all the things, energy and everything else you just mentioned. But it is really, really important, especially in just having a civil societies and just having civilization per se. There was a comment made by U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham a little while ago that went hardly even noticed, which troubled me because I did notice it. But it turns out Tucker Carlson also noticed it. And I'm just kind of curious as to what you think the significance of this is. Is it a big deal, or is it just, oh, it's just somebody bloviating? It's not really anything to pay attention to. Now, you're going to see that Tucker Carlson was pretty upset about it, but I'd like to see your view.
I feel good about the Republican Party. We're killing all the right people and we're cutting your taxes.
Cutting your taxes and killing all the right people. That really is the crispest way to describe the marriage of libertarian economics and neocon foreign policy. Cutting taxes and killing. And if you think about it, who'd want to be associated with that? Cutting taxes itself is hardly a virtue. It's a contextual matter. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It totally depends. But in Lindsey Graham's simplistic but heartfelt formulation, cutting taxes is just a positive, but always. And so is killing people. Killing the right people. No, they got to be the right people, but killing people. Killing people is just, it's just a good thing. Like, it's one of those things you don't need to describe. It's like sex with your wife. It's just good. Have you killed someone today? Oh, good. You have. Okay, good. That's how he thinks of it. You're a sick fuck if you say something like that, much less if you believe it. Killing people? And if you're gleefully in front of an audience applauding like seals, bragging about the killing that you are doing, that's really evil.
What do you think about that?
I'm completely at one with Tucker Carlson. I won't use his language, although I completely support it. But actually, I'm guessing that he's talking, amongst other things, about the extrajudicial murders, and they are murders, of people off the coast of Venezuela, you know, for which there is no legal regime that I can think of. And I would be very worried if I were those people who had been invited to do this. I think there's already been one resignation, a 3-star resignation in the States on the issue, and I can't say I blame him.
Southern Command Commander.
Yeah. I can't say I blame him, because actually what's being done there is, I can't think of a single legal regime. And the issue here is not just about whether it's right or wrong. It's obviously wrong. The issue is, so what in the rest of the world? What if the Chinese do this to, I don't know, to an American vessel off Taiwan? What's the argument? How can we say that we're right to do this, but nobody else can? And I think it's part of the hubris of the West. So, no, Lindsey Graham, I mean, he's definitely into that platoon of ours, Danny. It's abhorrent to think of these sorts of things and think in this way. I think, though, this is what we are going to see, I suspect, is that as we start to recognize, this will be particularly important in the States initially, and then as the States start to get out, I suspect the rest of Europe will, as we start to realize that actually we are no longer in a hegemonic world, we are no longer in a unipolar world, there are at least three nations here with significant capacity, and the US is one of the three superpowers in this but it's not the only one. And the other two have the power to outmatch the US, and probably in areas where the US thought that originally would be its place to actually win. And Taiwan is a very good example of that. So I think the sooner we start to accept that and the neocons are, you know, pushed out of this, hopefully, then the sooner we'll be in a position where we can start to actually get back to diplomacy and get back to talking to each other. You know, as I look at some of the things that are going on in China, you have to think to yourself, and I know this is a live debate in the States about reindustrialization. It's going to take 20 years. It's going to take 20 years to reindustrialize, if indeed it's possible. And, of course, the Chinese at the moment are producing, outproducing the rest of the West. And, of course, you know, I think I quoted in an article about the balance of power how Admiral Yamamoto, before Pearl Harbor, was very nervous about the Second World War. And he said something like, I won't get this quite right, Danny, but it'll be about right. He said something like, anybody who's seen the oil fields of Texas and the motor factories in Ohio knows that Japan will never be able to win in a naval race against the national power of the United States. It's about time we start to think like that and look across at China and look across at Russia and think in the same way, because it's clear to me that anybody who's seen the you know, the oil fields that are still producing to a level that they can export significantly, which the Americans can't, or the production the Chinese can do, will know that we in the West cannot at the moment, unless there's some major change in sort of energy, finding new energy sources or rebuilding our industrial capacity, we'll never win in terms of industrial power. I happen to think it's a good thing. I happen to think that the hubris that we've shown in the West has now come home to roost, and it's about time that we're going to have to accept that this is a different world where we don't rule the roost.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing is, or what could be the beautiful thing, is that we don't need to. We don't need to rule the roost. We can have a great quality of life, secure, safe, prosperous. We don't need to do any of that and put it all at risk, but I'm apparently preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, no, we don't need to. Let's talk to each other. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, the fact that we've got European leaders who congratulate themselves for not talking to Putin, it's madness. It's, you know, and I've said this before, we talked to the IRA throughout the 38-year campaign in Ireland. You know, the West and the Allies had conversations, difficult conversations with the Axis at times during the Second World War, and certainly during the First World War as well. You know, it doesn't mean to say that talking isn't giving in. It's actually understanding the other person's position, and actually it's building a relationship. I mean, I still admire Donald Trump for actually having the guts to talk to Putin. And although people sort of decried Donald Trump, I think you and I had a conversation, would have been a year ago, and I think you asked me the question, what does Putin want? And I think one of the things he wants in these conversations is a relationship. He wants to be able to talk to Donald Trump and to understand each other. And I think if you look back to Thatcher and Reagan on the one side and Gorbachev on the other side, they started talking. And that was one of the key aspects, I think, of ending the Cold War. And when you look at it as well, historiographically, you know, at the end of the Cold War, there were a lot of us on both sides of that war, and you and I both prepared for it. A lot of us on both sides of that war felt that, in retrospect, realized that neither side wanted to fight the other. And, you know, we don't know that until we start talking to each other. So I'm just looking forward to the time where we have European leaders who have the guts to talk to Putin. And even if it's a difficult conversation, and foreign secretaries have the guts to speak to Lavrov, and let's at least get that dialogue open. It's going to be settled on the battlefield.
That's what I fear, but I have the same hope that you do. And I hope springs eternal. As long as we haven't gone down that bad path, there's still a shot, and we want to continue to push down that and advocate for it like you did here. Thank you so much for coming on today. Steve, always a pleasure to have you on there, and look forward to having you back real soon.
Yeah, pleasure's mine, Danny. Thank you.
And we thank you guys, too. Always appreciate you. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that before you leave, and I look forward to seeing you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.